Welcome to The Brain Architects. I'm your host, Amelia Johnson, Communications Lead at the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. Today we're sharing an adaptation of our recent webinar, Solutions Spotlight, how communities are leading efforts to ensure clean water access. In this discussion, our panel of experts explore how communities are mobilizing to address disparities in water access and climate-related threats that are directly affecting children and their caregivers. We hope you enjoy this conversation. And remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Susan Crowley. I'm a senior project manager at the Center on the Developing Child. We are delighted to have you join us for today's webinar, Solutions Spotlight, how communities are leading efforts to ensure clean water access. Whether you're joining us for the first time or have been a regular at our webinars here at the Center, we're glad to have you here for this discussion today. Today's webinar is the second we're bringing to you on the topic of water access and quality. The Early Childhood Scientific Council on Equity and the Environment published a working paper on this topic last year. Our conversation today will focus on strategies to address the challenges many communities face in ensuring clean water access for children and their caregivers. We'll dive into disparities in water access across communities and provide you with specific ideas and resources. We want to thank those of you who submitted questions for our panel when registering for this event. We received some great questions, which we'll be addressing throughout the conversation. Our moderator today is Rebecca Hansen, Director of Communications at the Center on the Developing Child. She's joined today by Dana Ennis and Dr. Kay Aloha Fox. Dana Ennis serves as the executive director of the Urban Conservancy, a nonprofit based in New Orleans. She has also been part of New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell's transition team, serving on the Infrastructure Committee's Urban Water Subcommittee, and is a member of the Sewage and Water Board's Customer Advisory Board, and WaterNow Alliance's Equity Advisory Group to more directly assist those facing the first and worst consequences of flooding, contamination, and other impacts related to stormwater runoff. Dr. Kay Aloha Fox is the Deputy Director of the City and County of Honolulu's Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency, and Deputy Chief Resilience Officer for the island of Oahu, Hawaii. She brings over 20 years of experience in Native Hawaiian health, climate policy, and social health integration, bridging Indigenous innovation with Honolulu's efforts to create a more resilient future. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rebecca to begin our conversation.
All right. Thank you, Susan, and welcome to everyone who's joined us here today. I'm really excited to bring you today's conversation with our two panelists, Dana and Kay Aloha. As a quick note, I am stepping in today for our Chief Science Officer, Dr. Lindsay Burkhart, who was unfortunately unable to join as we originally planned. I know Lindsay really wishes she could be here today, and I will do my best to fill her shoes. So let me start by sharing a little bit more about why we are focusing on the topic of water in today's conversation. So here at the Center on the Developing Child, you know, we are working to shed light on the many ways that early childhood development and lifelong health are shaped by a child's developmental environment. And when we say developmental environment, what we're talking about is the full range of experiences and exposures that our children have in the places where they live, learn, play, and grow. So everything from the air quality in their early care settings, to the presence or lack of safe green space in their communities, to, you know, responsive, supportive relationships with the adults in their lives. All of these things matter. And what surrounds us quite literally shapes us, including children's developing biological systems. And the influences from the developmental environment can be both positive and negative in the impacts that they have on children. So those influences can fuel healthy development, things like breathing clean air, having access to safe, stable housing and nutritious foods. And those influences can also disrupt development. So things like toxic air from wildfire smoke or exposure to extreme heat during a heat wave. All of our children's developmental environments really have a mix of both positive and negative influences. And water, our focus for today, plays a critical role in the developmental environment in many different ways. So, as we all know, water is essential for life. Our bodies need a near constant supply of water, and its availability and quality are essential for child development and lifelong health. And in the United States, the systems that, you know, were once widely assumed to produce nearly universal, clean, affordable, and trustworthy water have serious gaps and challenges. Additionally, in many places, our freshwater supplies are being threatened by droughts, overuse, and contamination, all of which are made worse by climate change. So, for example, when an extreme rain event leads to flooding, drinking water can be contaminated when standing floodwaters leak into wellheads and percolate into well fields and other groundwater supplies that feed our drinking water systems. Children are particularly sensitive to what's in that water, including contaminants. They consume more water per pound than adults, so they ingest these things at higher doses. Their immune systems are also less developed than those of most adults, and the protective barrier around their rapidly developing brains is still forming, meaning that the toxic chemicals and contaminants are more likely to cross into the brain during pregnancy and early childhood, with potential for lifelong impacts. And in addition to these and other direct impacts on young children's developing biological systems, the increasing frequency and intensity of extreme weather events like floods and droughts can have important indirect effects on development. So when these types of events damage housing and infrastructure, families are often displaced, which can lead to major life disruptions in everything from accessing childcare and healthcare to food and other essential services. And caregivers can also be affected by physical injury, or they may suffer the loss of jobs or social support networks or even a loved one. And these situations and the stressors that they bring can lead to adverse mental health effects for caregivers, including things like anxiety and depression. This can all then impact children's development by affecting a caregiver's ability to provide for a child's basic needs, like food or housing, as well as the daily structure and routine and responsive caregiving that we know is so critical for supporting healthy development. The good news, which is a lot of what we're here to talk about today, is that there are many strategies and actions that we can take to reduce harm and support the health and development of our children. And communities across the country are putting these strategies into place already in all sorts of ways. And so it's great to have Kealoha and Dana join us for this conversation, as they both can really offer some great examples of solutions and strategies that we can implement in our communities to support young children and their caregivers. So I will welcome you both again. We are very excited to be here with you both and learn from you today.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with Kealoha. Can you share a little bit more about your work in Hawaii and your recent efforts to ensure children have access to clean and safe water supplies?
Aloha, veiringa mole, kealoha kapo, aloha, me ka ha'aha'a, me ka oia i'o. Thank you so much, Susan and Rebecca. And thank you to Harvard and its Center on the Developing Child and Team Spotlight. I'm really thrilled to be here today, especially with Dana. I can already tell we need much longer than an hour. I wish we could actually host a whole workshop on this. Dana, it's really quite a pleasure to be with you today. And thank you for all of the work that you've done over the years for your communities, as I get to share a little bit about mine. So just as you stated, Rebecca, you know, clean, safe, accessible water here in Hawaii looks different. And it looks different in each and every community and place. And that's really I think always the starting point, that's the foundation, right? Is how do we have that relationship with water in all of its forms and its sources so that we can really understand those functions and the ways that it affects all of us, but especially our children, our youth, right? We refer to them as our keiki, our opio, just a really tremendous part of their life and their growth is situated here in their ability to connect with place and to connect with these resources from a really early age and to build that bond so that their relationship isn't just one of extraction and looking at water as a utility like you might often find in a municipality, but looking at water as really that source of life, just as you mentioned in your introduction. And so in Hawaii, we refer to water in all of its many forms. So wai is our fresh water. Kai is our seawater. The alawai is our canals that distribute water throughout neighborhoods from the uplands to the near shore areas. Our punawai are actually the spring waters where the water is so pure and so clean. You've never tasted something as precious in your whole life as when you're able to go up to the punawai and really take in that, you know, just magical resource yourself. Our kaiko'o is our high surf. That's what we're seeing now within climate change. Our moana is our ocean. These waters and seas that actually connect all of us, that show that we are a part of a system that together we need to really address as a shared global community. And our ua, that's our rainwater. That's so much of what we need to replenish safely our groundwater reserves. But we know that those are really shifting conditions during climate change as well. So just like you said, Rebecca, water is life. We say ole i ka wai here because that is so much a part of our origin story. And for us as Kanaka Wīwī, as Native Hawaiians, our relationship to water really has to be understood firstly through an Indigenous perspective prior to jumping into any singular view or collective solution that we might want to effort and resource around. So for us, we have that true relationship with our natural environment and all of the ways that these elemental forces show up across the lifespan. And so for me, I always approach the conversation first as a Kanaka Wīwī, as a Native Hawaiian woman, as a person of this community, but also as a scientist, as a clinician, and as somebody who's a strong advocate to make sure that everybody has fair and equal and equitable access to these resources for the long term of their life course, which we're trying to build definitely intergenerationally and multi-generationally here, just because of the makeup of our islands and the scarcity of resources, we really have to come together between generations. And so water for my work now is really addressed to the context of sustainability and resiliency and really looking at the perils and possibilities that climate change brings to us. And then what are those actions that we can take? So on behalf of the city and our core municipal services, how do you balance agency, people power, and all of these different shared knowledge systems across stakeholders so that communities together can lead efforts to ensure clean water access? And I know these are definitely conditions that Dana and I really agree on in making sure that no one stakeholder can really do it alone, right? And ought not to, because these are shared resources. These natural and elemental forces in all of their form and functions that really belong to all of us, which also means here that we have a collective responsibility and obligation for their protection, accessibility, safeguarding, if you will. And so I just kind of wanted to start there before I jump into some of more of like the concrete projects and solutions, because I think that worldview and that framing is so important for all of us together today as we step back and we think about what is our role, but then what is our collective role and how do we see water as it relates to the development of our keiki and our opio and our greatest resource for our people to thrive, which is our children and that next generation.
Thank you so much for that. It's really beautiful to hear all those different words and ways of referring to water, you know, within your communities, and really appreciate that collective and communal perspective in terms of the responsibility that we all have in this complex system to get to a sustainable place to have high quality drinking water for all of our communities. Building on that, Dana, I will turn to you next. Can you share a little bit more about your work with the Urban Conservancy and, you know, any ways in particular that that relates to supporting young children and their access to drinking water?
I certainly can. I don't promise to be as eloquent as Ke Aloha was. I just was sitting here like, this is my poetry and my motivation for the day and for moving forward, because that was just really beautifully put. So thank you for that. It was interesting to think about, like, you know, how we frame it too here in those same ways, like the many ways that water influences our lives, quality, quantity, you know, the river, the lake, we're surrounded by water here in New Orleans, and for the river below us, the lake above us, we're really hemmed in, and yet we're so far away from having an accessible relationship with water in a lot of ways. And that's part of what our work is and really has been since Katrina, a shift to kind of understanding our work with the wise stewardship of our built environment. Our built environment needs our water too. It's not just the land where we program, if you will, our activities, the buildings and the green spaces and all of that. It's the water too, but it took Katrina really to make us realize that. And then through our work then to incorporate sort of a better understanding and a better relationship involving living with water, that's where our work with children came in. As we worked more and more with adults, that we were all as adults having this aha moment, like, oh, we're a coastal city. Oh, what does that mean? You know, rising sea levels, eroding coastlines, subsidence, 60 inches of rain, you know, a storm surge, all of this. As adults, as we were just learning this in our 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s through Katrina, it made us realize this is information that children are not going to get through their curriculum, their school, necessarily, unless we start baking that in any way we can, because we want those kids as our future land and water stewards to have this just integrated into how they see the world, not something that they have to learn the way we learned it post-Katrina. So with that, we've created programs to incentivize homeowners to change, really transform their property, to understand themselves as the first line of defense, and transform their properties by removing pavement, concrete, impermeable surfaces, replacing them with nature-based solutions and green spaces to make us both cooler and less flood prone. But then we've also at the same time been building children's programs to bring this knowledge and these opportunities and this wondering about the natural world and what their role in it is to kids. And then through their parents, also the work that we do into the younger children as well. So, and one thing that I definitely want to touch on that our program called Basin is this program that is working with children. Basin stands for, it's where we are. We're in a basin, but of the Mississippi River. It stands for Building Active Stewardship in New Orleans. And the program idea, and this gets back to what Rebecca was saying at the beginning, this idea of deficiency, but also opportunity, possibility, as Kayla had said, within deficiency. So Kendrick was as a native New Orleanian, grew up here. And he, as a young man, after his service in the Marine Corps, after being one of the individuals who was up on his roof during Katrina as the floodwaters rose, has a very harrowing tale, but then came to us through a fellowship and worked with us to develop Basin. And it was from that perspective of a kid, very athletic kid, growing up to be a very athletic adult, but saying, but there were things that should have been incorporated. It shouldn't have just been baseball or football, or, you know, it should have been, or basketball. It should have been chess. It should have been an understanding of our history. It should have been an understanding of our natural world. Why can't we do something that is taking the whole kid and exposing them to all of these things that make living here worth living here? And so it was his vision that became Basin. And that was 12, 13 years ago when we started thinking about, well, what would that look like? So I like that idea of taking what is deficient or missing in your life and looking at that and knowing that's not right, and developing a passion and sort of a mode of action from that. And I love to see that and support that. So that's part of what we're doing. And then just in addition to that, with Basin, we have also are working in lots of schools, bringing these ideas, this sort of let's design thinking, if you will, to their playgrounds and saying, what is it that we can do together to create a better, safer, more enjoyable, cooler, less puddled playground for you, and helping them work as 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds start thinking about what it is that they can influence within their own environment to make them feel safer and healthier. And that program is called Youth Envision. So we're working in several schools with several partners on that as well.
That's great. Thank you. And I really appreciate the sort of whole child perspective that it sounds like you both bring to this work in terms of, you know, helping children also to understand their relationship to water in the natural world. And I also appreciate, Dana, you mentioning the importance of the built environment when we're thinking about water, because at the center, when we talk about the developmental environment, both the built and natural environments are a big part of that. And I think we often think of water as part of the natural environment and a natural resource, which of course it is, but it absolutely crosses over into that built environment domain in terms of how it flows to us and around us. You know, the way we structure that built environment has a big, big impact. So, you know, just to revisit really quickly where I sort of shared at the start, you know, the systems in our built environment that, you know, bring water to us in the United States, we've, I think, often assumed in the past that these are providing universal, clean, trustworthy water to our homes and other places. But, you know, in reality, there are some serious challenges that we face on that front, including the fact that our freshwater supplies are being threatened increasingly by droughts and overuse and contamination. So a question for both of you, maybe starting with Kealoha, can you talk a little bit about how you are observing disruptions in clean water access affecting the communities you serve, particularly the children in your communities?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Rebecca. And thanks for having us mention to our guests and participants today. Whole health, whole child, whole community perspectives are so essential for us to be able to not only look at the problems holistically, but also then define what our strategies are going to be to close these gaps or ameliorate some of these harms. And so I just wanted to share a little bit of data, since a lot of times when people hear about Hawaii, when they have visited the island of Oahu and seen the city of Honolulu, for example, they might have this like a fantasy approach of like, this is place that they go on vacation and it's this place for tourism. But we do have a lot of data around the changing conditions around all of these water forms and functions. And so we already know that by 2050, our sea levels in Honolulu are expected to rise significantly compared to our ability to start measuring this in about 2000. And so what we're looking at right now is projections that can be, you know, as high as nearly 6 feet by 2100. And then we're starting to see many more days of flooding throughout the year, both minor and moderate flooding, which we know disrupts many people from across our county, because we are a mix of urban, rural, coastal, inland. We have agricultural lands, we have an amount of conservation lands, and then we also have a significant holding of military lands. We're really actually trying to monitor and assess and track all of this at one time. And so what we do know is that we're already seeing more frequent and severe droughts on the drier side of our islands, which we call the leeward sides. We're already seeing an expected precipitation decrease by about 60%. And then our extreme rainfall events are happening, especially in La Nina year events. And so we're going from like these one in every 23 year storms to these one in every 13 year storms. And then now we're going to see them even more frequently, which Dana in New Orleans is no stranger to either, right? So as the island's deputy chief resilience officer, it's really important, I think, for me to make sure that we're understanding all of these data points and these conditions so that we can make sure that then we're relating that back to the quality of like the human experience and people's ability to live in their homes. Are we going to be able to keep these schools in their, you know, same positions now? Are we going to have to plan and construct our neighborhoods and civil services differently in the future? Yes, and that's already starting. So we've already done surveys within our office to show that 77% of residents here are extremely concerned about decreasing fresh water supply. And nearly three quarters of our residents expect children to be worse off because of climate change impacts in relationship to those shifts in water. What that means for us is we're already seeing high rates of out-migration and internal migration within the islands themselves. And so that already shows us that we're sometimes steps behind what community, what families, what children and their parents and grandparents are experiencing on a lived day-to-day basis, right? And so our policies and our programs actually have to sprint to try to catch up so that we not only just understand these conditions, but then we can try to act and do something about it as you know, as sworn, protected, and civil servants. And so one of the areas that I did really want to highlight that we talked a little bit about in the introduction is the disruption to frontline communities. And so as Dana was talking about Basin in New Orleans, like those are the same, you know, ideas and concerns and thoughts that I think our children are sharing here in Hawaii too. And so for us, we do have City Resolution 20-206 that really codifies frontline communities for Oahu. And in those 10 frontline communities, we do also have a special carve out for children and youth and also elders and seniors, because we're also trying to make sure that when we think about frontline communities, we're making sure that we're taking a generational approach too, and we're making sure that any of the solutions that we come up with make sense to the target population and the special needs that they have. And so that helps us, I think, move into strengths-based research, programming, and policy making. And so we're able to couple that with tools like a social vulnerability index so that we can really look at community resilience factors and move beyond vulnerability conditions and really look at these assets and strengths through a data-driven and science-backed way. And we feel like that is really important right now as there are forces out there that want us to move away from discussions around frontline communities and our centering of equity and our foundations of justice. We feel like we actually can't stop on that because we know that climate change is not going to impact every community the same way, and that the composition of family size, the percentage of children and elders in the family, families that have single parents, their socioeconomic status, their ability to have a livable, you know, wage and income and quality health is all going to be the reasons why they can stay in their home islands here, or if they're going to have to move, which is not a condition unknown throughout the other Pacific islands. And so for us, I think all of these steps really help us to not only lessen vulnerabilities, acknowledge the data and the gaps that we're seeing, but really increase specific locations, greater resilience, and overall like long-term sustainability for this long-term health and multi-generational health that we strive for.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that perspective on the importance of combining the data and the science with the lived experience of your communities to make sure that the solutions that get put into place really meet their needs and their concerns. And Dana, you know, I'll pose the same question to you in terms of sharing a little bit about how you're seeing disruptions in clean water access affecting the communities that you serve and the children who live there.
Absolutely. And I think I'm just waiting for, I don't know if it's just me or if we're all hearing the word polycrisis more and more these days. Suddenly that's the word, but I'm waiting for the book Parenting Through Polycrisis, because it feels like what we are talking about is families dealing with, when we talk about unpredictability in weather, we're talking about unpredictability in our own daily lives. And we're talking about unpredictability in whether we can get our kids to school and whether the schools will be able to be open. Like whether or not we have a boil water advisory in New Orleans, that happens periodically, what that means for our kids. So I think, you know, as we think about this, what where we are in New Orleans, is trying to become comfortable with the sort of, I don't want to, it sounds like I'm saying let's normalize trauma, and I'm not. I'm saying let's plan for continued disruptions and think about how they're affecting us, including our clean water access. And clean water access, I mean, we can focus on the drinking water piece of it, but for us, that clean water access means so much. It means developing a comfort with water, like knowing you can basically trust the water that is around you and having access to water to develop something other than a kind of a trauma-informed reaction to water. I guess I just anecdotally, I just want to say, and I mentioned this, there's in 2010, we did a TEDx NOLA talk down here, and one of the speakers has a presentation called Lido, New Orleans, I think, and he was just talking about how post-Katrina, like a lot of what we have here is trauma around water. And that's intergenerational. You know, that's passed from parent to child, the anxiety around water, you know, stay away, don't touch that. It's also the lack of access doesn't help. We don't have comforting ways to interact with water. So I encourage you, it's old, but it's 6 minutes, and I encourage you to take a look. It's important. But along those lines, it's sort of like, how do we mitigate for those potential disruptions? So there are things that are happening at the city level in partnership with the state, the municipal level, in terms of lead line replacement, that it can reassure parents that water coming into their home, the water coming to the line coming into their home is safe and healthy and regulated and clean. The water that from that last little chunk from the street to their house may not be, depending, we're a 300-year-old city, and those pipe, some of those lines are about that old too. So those, a lot of those are lead pipes. So there is a replacement effort underway there. There are things that we're doing, investing in resilience hubs that keep us from having to necessarily evacuate to shelter in place as safely as we possibly can, where you don't have to worry about disruption to access to clean water and to other things. Should a hurricane come and our services go down, we're creating these spaces that are accessible for all New Orleanians, public spaces where you can be assured that you can have these essentials, including clean water. I think another thing, and there's another resource I'd like to share with you, and this is a podcast called Water Loop, and it was called Dissecting Distrust in the Tap. And I think another part of what we would like to do through investment and good information going out from our municipal water service is to get away from this idea that bottled water is safer or better or healthier. Because it isn't. And then it also contributes to the plastic issue. So helping kids to understand that, but also being sure, you know, that what we're saying, that they are indeed safe. So I like the example from, I think it's Michigan, where they have, they are really investing statewide in improving systems within the school systems to ensure that the water is filtered and safe. So these are things that we can look at to ensure that relationship with water is healthy at that level too, and that the access is not disrupted.
That's great. Thank you. That's a lot of different ways and pathways for addressing these issues, which is really helpful to hear. And I really appreciate that perspective on emphasizing the need to plan for continued disruption, because I think that when we're thinking about the solution space, that's one way to get to that sort of like long-term sustainable resiliency that Kealoha is also talking about. So I do want to kind of sort of get into that solution space now at this point, because I think that's what a lot of our audience members are probably interested to hear from the two of you about. And, you know, just want to note that a lot of these threats and issues that the two of you have been naming and have been discussing are the result of decisions that have been made over time that have shaped the way that our environments are designed and that water is, you know, showing up in our communities. And I think part of the good news, as you've also both been emphasizing, is that we can redesign those environments to address inequities and better support healthy development for all of our children with different decisions going forward. And that includes opportunities across policies, systems, and programs. And, you know, here at the center, we tend to think about opportunities in the solution space at three different levels. And I'll name those just quickly. So it's protect, adapt, and prevent. So when we say protect, we are talking about immediate actions that we can take to reduce harm to children. So things like implementing an early warning system that enable timely and safe evacuations before an extreme weather event or storm occurs. And when we say adapt, you know, we're talking about allocating resources toward improving current services, systems, and infrastructure. So things like updating sewer systems and water storage facilities so that, you know, the water coming that in our supplies is safe and also protected against those type of extreme weather events. And then when we talk about, you know, prevention, it's really about addressing the root causes behind, you know, our rapidly warming world and, you know, thinking about actions like investing in renewable energy sources. So there's sort of like the small scale, more immediate actions all the way through thinking about the bigger picture. And you've both talked about a lot of different sort of strategies and tools that you're implementing. And I want to just ask, you know, for our audience members who may be in their communities wondering what they can do or what they can advocate for, can you share a little bit more about effective strategies that you've seen in your community or other communities to ensure that children are better protected from the impacts of climate-related water disruptions in their communities? And maybe, Kealoha, we'll start with you.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca. And we have, similarly in our Climate Ready Oahu plan, we also have these, you know, three areas of solutions too. So we're really looking at not simply promoting climate adaptation without also addressing climate mitigation. So we know it's too late to stop climate change and its impacts. It's already happening in my community, in Dana's community. But right now is the best time for us to do as much as we can to prevent the catastrophic impacts that we know we're going to see at an increasingly alarming rate, and which communities and which populations are going to be impacted by those more severely. We can do so much of that preventative health work together. And that's what so many of us have been trained to do ultimately, right? Our other areas, really local impacts need local solutions. So this is a global responsibility, but adapting to the impacts of climate change, we see as really a local a tool set that needs to be created with a lot of intentionality and making sure that everyone is looking at those opportunities and strengths that I had mentioned before, and making sure that we're not just trying to have, you know, a panacea, if you will, or prescription that we write that is applicable from one state to the next or one jurisdiction to the other. And then making sure in our other area that we're navigating a climate ready future together. And so really knowing and embracing that this is a monumental task, and it requires any stakeholder, any agency, any leader to really step outside of their comfort zone now, reach beyond the silos, and making sure that we're starting to what we refer to as create Lau Lima, like what's the collective action look like, and move beyond the talking and move into the doing, because that's what our residents and constituents are really asking for us to do. And really, you know, that's our responsibility and our role. And so when we think think about climate mitigation, you know, some of the examples that we know really work in our Ola Resilience Strategy from 2019 is making sure that we're looking at reducing greenhouse gas emissions from water-based activities. And so we need to make sure that we're increasing sustainable agriculture. And one of the ways that we do that in Hawaii, and especially through an indigenous perspective, is making sure that we're promoting crop diversification, because we know that that is not only great to decrease water consumption, but that also is really great for the link between water and food as the overall system to help keep meet children and youth basic needs, right? We're really at a basic needs point here when we have 90% of Hawaii's food is imported outside of Hawaii. And that's we just can't have that if we're going to continue to adapt to climate change. And that's helping people to prepare for action. And so some of those things that we want to see in terms of the adaptation strategies is really the increase of flood resilience protection. And so right now, FEMA is going through this massive update all across the country for, you know, this flood mapping initiative. And so to make sure that we're implementing flood management strategies that protects communities, their infrastructure, and their livelihood, because we know that we're going to see increased rainfall and flooding. It's definitely paramount. And it's top of mind for all of us starting right now, today, in terms of the FEMA notices that went out. Coastal protection for us is paramount. We have to implement coastal protection measures as an island community, as we think about sea level rise, as we think about storm surges and the tides that we have. It's a moon right now for us tonight. And while that is really, really magical and beautiful and has all of these different energies, it can also bring what we refer to as like these king tides, where the storm surge is really, really high. And we have people, infrastructure, you know, adult daycare centers, childcare centers right in these areas where the king tides do surge on a regular basis now. And then, of course, our biodiversity stewardship, conservation and resource management. We have to do so much better at restoring our wetlands, our forests, our natural ecosystems, because not only do they act as carbon sinks, but they also help buffer against those extreme weather events like floods and droughts. And so that we can embrace, you know, water as a resource resilience factor. And so those are some of the things that we know and we're promoting that we're doing, and would just love to hear more from Dana about what they're working on too in New Orleans.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And Dana, I would guess that many of those ways of thinking you probably share as another coastal community, but would love to hear from you quickly on any additional thoughts on that front.
Sure, completely. I completely agree. And it's so interesting too, because that thing that we didn't know how close we were to water, it sounds like, you know, you can't escape it. But we really, until Katrina, Mary Landrieu, our senator at that time, describes when she was a little girl in the 70s, she said she would go around with her dad, Moon Landrieu, who was the mayor at the time, and they were driving down through the French Quarter, and they saw a father, the tourist, with his daughter on her shoulders, looking over a wall in the French Quarter by Café du Monde, if you've ever been here, to see the Mississippi River, which was right on the other side. And he said, well, you've got to do something about that. So he put up a ladder so tourists could climb up the ladder and look at the Mississippi River. Now there's an entire riverfront. But that cutting off us off from one of life's most essential ingredients, if you will, is a big part of why we are where we are. So in addition to, in terms of solutions, what we're doing in ways of creating access points to just knowing water, interacting with water, having a better, healthier, safer relationship with water, experiencing joy and comfort from water, that we still have a lot of work to do. But I think that's essential for us to honor all of the ways that clean water is essential and to act accordingly. So the lead line replacement is an example of sort of multi-lever layer. There's a role for individuals to play too in terms of responding and signing up for the service for the replacement and that sort of thing. It's wonderful. It's also politically dependent on, you know, things that believe that this is critical and important. And right now it's something that we are able to make some progress on, which is wonderful. I think the other part, like to make systemic change, has to do with embedding what we know and what our kids know and sense into their lives in whatever ways we can. So with our basin program, it's an extracurricular. It's a Saturday morning once a month where we touch on these different aspects of water and their relationship with it and what they can do about it through hands-on experiential things. We work with a collaborative called the Ripple Effect, which is working at a much more structured formal level to embed our relationship with water in the Louisiana social studies curriculum. So that's like a very formal and a heavy lift, but there are several organizations and educators working on that together. So, you know, there are different levels to tap into in terms of scalability. Some of these things are very scalable, and that others are more dependent on external resources and that sort of thing to make them happen. One thing that I would say that I would love to see, and if you watch that Lido New Orleans, you'll see like a big part of our fear of water has to do with what is communicated from parent to child. And in terms of one of the easiest solutions, I don't know why it's so difficult, but I would love to see every child learn to swim by the time they're five, as they do in the Netherlands, have the political will to put a program like that into place. I think would completely change how everyone is interacting with water as a resource and a right, I would also say.
That's great. And I think, you know, we did get a lot of questions from our audience submitted ahead of time. So I want to hopefully have time for at least one of those. And for those of you who submitted questions, thank you again. And even if we don't get to your question, you know, we have them all here now, so we can always think about other opportunities to kind of speak to some of the questions that you shared. But you both mentioned actually sort of like the political context that this work has to take place in different ways. Kealoha thinking in terms of like breaking down silos and moving from talk to action, and Dana in terms of that piece of the political will. And we did get several questions from our audience related to strategies for ensuring that, you know, all children and families can have access to clean water, particularly in this political climate that we're in, which is really sort of changing, you know, every day. And I'm wondering, you know, whichever of you wants to speak to this, or both of you, if you could share your recommendations for ways to advance this work that can bridge political and cultural differences while also taking community needs and perspectives into account.
I want to thank the audience for that question. I think we're doing that each and every day here in Hawaii. As a Native Hawaiian, you know, the United States continues to occupy Hawaii and our unceded lands of our indigenous territory for many years now. And so we are constantly navigating and code switching and facilitating solutions across bridges, across lines, across silos. And that's just this natural way in which we're trying to bring and restore balance at all times as people. And so, you know, if we're, you know, any example of what you can do for generations to stay positive and stay optimistic and keep doing the work, I think that's so much of what so many folks I'm talking to right now are trying to understand of like, when these days are really, really hard, how do you stay positive and how do you keep an upbeat approach? And we don't have any other choice, right? There is no plan B for our earth, and especially for these resources. And so we have to start and we have to come together. And I know it can be really difficult, but it is why I'm so passionate about the opportunity for local decision making and also local action when we do bring together the whole child, whole health, and whole community perspectives, because it allowed you to think beyond federal government or state government either. And it really like helps you situate what you can do on such a microcosm and scale that many times actually gets generalized upstream rather than getting the worst of it coming downstream.
That's a great answer. I mean, I think that's there's so much that we can continue to do that is community based, that has nothing to, that falls outside of the political framework. You know, it's just people to people, it's mutual aid, it's organization to organization, and it's unmediated by those factors that may be saying no, you know, and those are words that are, you know, prohibited. You can't say those things. Well, we can, and we do, and we're going to get, like, as you said, you know, it's the work must continue, and the work will continue because these are lives. So I think also just on a very, like, here we live in what is, you know, our slogan, our motto, state motto is sportsman's paradise. You'll see it on some of our license plates. And I think there are points, like looking for those points of connection where you may be very not politically aligned, but you're looking at things that you, looking across the aisle, if you will, to the person who treasures what you treasure, maybe in different ways. Ducks Unlimited, for example, is often a very great partner with environmental efforts. And it's, those are the sorts of points of connection, like find those points of connection and hold on to those where you can, and, you know, where you can work together, look for the opportunities. And I think I love that code switching. I think that's just absolutely the name of the game.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate both of those perspectives. And so we're coming up close to the end of our time here. The hour has really flown by. And in terms of just sort of last closing thoughts for this audience, I'm wondering if you could each just quickly share your thinking around what feels most important to you in terms of what needs to happen in the next 5 to 10 years to ensure more sustainable, as we've been talking about, resilience, and importantly, equitable access to clean water in communities across the country. And that could be sort of like at the macro policy level, but also I imagine a lot of people in our audience are thinking about what they can do in their own communities to try to advance this work and ensure access. So at any level, maybe just sort of one last thought for our audience about what you see as most important, most actionable in the coming years on this front. Dana, you look like you're thinking, but do you have a thought to start us off?
I do have a thought right now, and that is as various election opportunities come up, even if it isn't something that you know, that isn't your thing, it formulate those questions about what is, formulate those questions and get those candidates on record, and encourage the people at all of those different levels, because that's really where the things can happen. Encourage the people you know would be great in those positions and be an advocate. If we can move in, get the people that we need in there that we know will be responsive public servants to the questions and concerns that we have and the data that we have to present and offer and can work with us as partners, I think that's really critical. And there is something at whatever level, even if that's formulating a question in a public forum, at a candidates forum, that sort of thing, and going from there in terms of your level of involvement. I think that's really important right now.
That's great. Thank you. And Kaloha, any closing thought?
I have so many. I think Dana and I could keep going. We could definitely do a part two. I mean, there's so much that we can do on a small level of making sure that in locations you have access to public drinking water fountains for safe and clean water, you know, promoting the use of refillable, you know, water cups and flasks and all of those things, making sure that that's accessible in every school. In childcare facility, I mean, those are things that we just ought to be doing much more of. And I know from being out there and doing field research that it's just not always the case. And it's a little bit harder sometimes to get these actions done, especially when you're trying to replace old drinking fountains in, you know, these aging facilities, right? People tend to think of this as like a luxury and like later on the facility's maintenance list. And I think we come from a camp of saying, no, this is actually a core to how the space in general is even used and created. And we ought to think of it that way. I think everybody should definitely get involved in, you know, whether it's local stream cleanups, really see where your water is coming from, have that connection that we started off on our panel with. Like, there's nothing, I think, that can replace that connection that you see and you feel and you touch and you smell either in the pristine way or in the degraded way than being there with your own, you know, with yourself. And then making sure that agencies go above and beyond and making sure that we're offering resources, especially to children, teachers, right? Like we shouldn't be expecting teachers to know all of this data and this science and all of these solutions. Just like Dana was saying, the integration into social studies curriculum is fabulous. And what would it look like if you had a whole water curriculum that an entire school or grade could encompass of social studies and science and language arts and culture and field trips and experiential place-based learning, right? Like there's infinite possibilities. And then I guess I'll lastly close with my hope and dream is that people look at the infrastructure of roadways, buildings, parks, and trees and treatment plants and utilities as actually part of this larger integrated system. Because just like as we started, you know, that's how I'll close. Ole Kawai, water is life. None of us can live without it. It is a shared condition that each and every one of us face, regardless of our age, our race, our religion, our location. And so it's something that we can all get behind because we have that personal relationship with it, not just one that is professional.
Well, thank you so much to both of you for your time and your expertise today. It's been inspiring and really interesting to learn from the two of you. And I feel like our audience is walking away with just a wealth of ideas and information in terms of all the opportunities that we really have to work together on this front.
Thank you for listening to The Brain Architects. Be sure to check out the Center on the Developing Child's website and social channels to learn more about how water affects early childhood development and find strategies to address disparities in water access and climate-related threats. On our channels, you can also find science on a range of early childhood development topics, from the importance of responsive relationships to toxic stress, to how climate change is affecting early childhood development. See you next time.